This is Critical Edge. Today we're here with Joseph Nye. He's a renowned American political science, famous for much theoretical work, which we'll be getting into. But he's also served for the Clinton administration in international security, as well as many other commendable things during his career. Joseph, thank you for coming on and for having a chat with us today.
It's my pleasure.
So the first question we like to ask all of our guests, sort of to get an insight into the way their brain works before we talk about exactly what they think, is when was the last time you changed your mind in a significant way?
Oh, I may change it several times, but maybe the last time politically was about Biden. I had higher expectations for him, and I think he ended poorly. So that's something of a mind change.
What specifically about the ending there did you think was poor?
Well, I thought the pardoning of his family basically allowed Trump to say that what Trump was doing was normal. I thought Biden should have upheld standards on that. And I also think before that, his deciding to not to step down as he had originally suggested he would after first term, I think was a serious mistake.
I mean, on the topic of Trump, he's just been elected, he's just taken office in America. And this episode will be coming out about 2 weeks from when we're recording this now. So it'll still be quite timely. I was wondering what you think about or what you've thought about his first few days in office.
Well, I don't agree with Trump politically, but if one simply looks at his skill as a manipulator of communications and audience attention, he's done quite a good job. I think the content of many of the executive orders that he has released in a blizzard, the content of some of them is absolutely dreadful. For example, taking away birthright citizenship, which is clearly written in the Constitution. And there are several others where he is gone against law. By essentially swamping the system with his information, he's been able to totally dominate the agenda. Makes it difficult then for opponents to organize to defeat any particular aspect of his blitzkrieg. So one can dislike the content of what he's doing, but also say that he's extremely skillful at doing it. After all, he did come up on reality television, where the trick is to make sure that if you say something outrageous, before you can be corrected, go on to the next outrageous thing, and or leave your opponents back trying to unscramble the previous outrageous thing while you go to a third. Trump is extremely good at this.
Yeah, I read that in your latest book, A Life in the American Century, in your chapter on Trump and Biden. And it seems to me a lot of your grievances, not solely, but partly have to do with Trump's style and his form of communication and his, let's say, the way he grabs attention to push his own agenda.
Well, one has to, as a political analyst, one has to distinguish style from substance. You can admire his ability to manipulate the system of communication without admiring the ethics of it, either in content or in style. After all, if you look back historically, Adolf Hitler was brilliant at manipulating the new media of radio and movies, but that doesn't mean he was a good man.
I don't suppose there's a there's any kind of truth there in the comparison there between Hitler and Trump. I think some people would take, well, I would at least take some pushback. I would give some pushback to that. I don't know if that's an analogy.
I was not making the analogy of Trump and Hitler. What I was trying to make was a broader analytical point that when one does an analysis, one can distinguish the nature of the skill in using communications from the moral justification of it. I don't think Trump is like Hitler, but I think that both of these men are brilliant at manipulating communications, just like Franklin Roosevelt was brilliant at mastering radio in the United States, which was a new medium at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I obviously don't mean to say that that was the kind of point you're making. I think it's interesting when it comes to comparing, let's say, historical figures with current figures, that those waters are also treaded quite carefully. Let's say, I don't know if you, you must have seen Musk's recent salute while giving a speech. I think maybe first of all, it might be interesting to hear your thoughts of that before we can kind of break that down.
Well, I don't know how to interpret it. I've seen a couple of pictures and some things that are quoted from social media, but I can't give you a judgment call on that. I don't know what it meant.
No, fair enough. I mean, just on the topic of Musk, as we relate back to Trump as well, I wanted to maybe focus in on one point which I heard come up quite often while doing research for the interview, while listening to a couple of your talks as well. And that's the idea that there's been a shift from horizontal power to vertical power. And for our audience listening, that is to say, there's more and more non-government actors taking power within states. So maybe for our listeners and for our audience, how relevant, first of all, do you think this is to international relations more broadly?
Well, I think if you look at what's happening with information and communications today, what you see is an increase in the extraordinary amount of information that's being conveyed, which then means there's a burden on the scarce resource, which is attention. And so if you can completely dominate the information channels, then you can actually have considerable success in setting the agenda of action. So if you think of what does this mean in terms of international relations, you have many more actors who have access to these channels of communication. And that means that they can play a larger role in agenda setting. The days in which you had a few major elite newspapers who would determine the agenda for the government are eroded, or if not gone. And nowadays, if you have a podcast or a million followers on social media, you can do a lot to control the agenda. So what you've had with the rise of the internet, social media, this will be increased even more by artificial intelligence, is more actors working at lower costs to them, so the price of entry is down, and working at much greater speeds, and all this targeted on an amount of attention which doesn't increase. So that does make a change.
Is that necessarily a bad thing, that more actors kind of have that power? I don't know if it's necessarily bad to kind of give, it kind of democratizes the media to some extent.
It does, and there are good aspects and there are bad aspects of it. The good aspects of it is that you have more people able to express a broader agenda. The bad aspects of it is that it can be manipulated. If you have the ability to set up a bot You can swap a social media platform with messages which are highly biased. So it's a mixed bag.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Yeah, just on that point, I was wondering what you thought about Trump and his relationship with X, especially now that Elon Musk kind of owns X, formerly known as Twitter.
I think without social media and the internet, it's hard to see that Trump would have been elected. But that goes back to my point that whether you like it or not, you have to admire his skill.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I kind of wanted to quickly, before moving on to maybe the broader theoretical aspect of things, focus a little bit on Trump in relation to Ukraine, because this is one of the more pressing issues, I think, which he hasn't spoken too much about. So he signed lots of executive orders. There hasn't been too much going on about Ukraine, I feel. How likely do you think it is that Trump now purposefully weakens Ukraine's position economically or through some form of soft power in order to reach a ceasefire on his terms, maybe on Russia's terms as well?
Well, I wrote a column about this a month or so ago before the inauguration, saying that Trump prides himself in unpredictability. So we really don't know what he's going to do. And what I said in the column is, if he continues to strengthen Ukraine's position to get a ceasefire in place, rather than letting Putin claim the four provinces that he has invaded but not been able to fully control or annex, then you would have something where you could not call it a complete victory, but you could call it a partial victory for Ukraine. If, on the other hand, he deprives Zelensky and Ukraine of military assistance so that Putin feels that he's got a guarantee that if he presses ahead, he will prevail on the objectives such as those I just mentioned, or even more, then I think you will have something which will be widely seen as a defeat. And I think that defeat is not good for Ukraine. It's not good for Europe. It's not good for NATO. And we'll have to see what Trump does. But he's so unpredictable that I don't begin to know the answer.
Okay. I mean, just in relation to the Russian-Ukraine war right now, I was speaking to a friend who is quite familiar with your work, and he thought that it might be wise in this interview to bring up isolationist realism and its rise in popularity, especially now in the wake of this war. And I'll let you answer that before kind of opening up the discussion a bit further.
Well, there has been a reaction in American opinion in the direction of isolationism. One has to be careful with the use of the term. It's not like the isolationism of the 1930s. But if you look at the Chicago Council...
Could you clarify isolationism? Sorry to interrupt there,
well,
just for
no,
our audience
just
a little bit.
That isolation in the 1930s was the Americans saying, we want nothing to do with Europe, and we're not going to do anything to deter Hitler or Mussolini. And the Congress passed bills such as the Neutrality Act, which prevented our assistance. Roosevelt fought against this, but it took him a long time. And it actually was the Japanese bombing at Pearl Harbor that broke through this. But the point is, there is a strong strand in American opinion, which is measured by the council, the Chicago Council, which shows that about a quarter of the American people have said consistently that we should have a foreign policy which minded our own business, so to speak. And then there have been something like, oh, I don't know, anywhere between 60 and 70% who said we have to take a leading position. That has been true since Vietnam, or the reaction against Vietnam. But there's some indications that it may be increasing, this mind your own business approach may be increasing. And it's not necessarily left or right. There are some of these tendencies on the left, and there's some on the right. But how strong they'll become and how much they'll influence the administration over the next 4 years, I think there's still going to be a dominant strand which will involve or keep the U.S. involved. But there may be a difference in degree of how much involvement.
Yeah, I've had this debate with a couple of my friends as well, and in my social circles, in that I'm quite strongly on the position that U.S. should be involved. They should fund Ukraine. However, I've had my views challenged quite strongly, especially when kind of it's put to me the idea of the American person, the average American person who's struggling. And this is something I heard you speak about a little bit in a podcast. It's the idea of why should we worry about what's 50 years from now, whether that's the climate's erosion or Russia's potential rise in power in the Far Eastern bloc, when what's happening right now is our economic struggles.
Well, I think it helps to put this in a longer historical perspective.
Sure.
I titled my memoir, A Life in the American Century, because in 1941, the term the American Century, which was coined by the publisher Henry Luce, was to argue that since the Americans had become the most powerful country, if they didn't help promote some degree of international order, it wouldn't be produced at all. And I think that even though the American century today is very different from what it was in 1945 when the U.S. had half a world product, the U.S. still remains the strongest power. Since 1970, it's been about 25% of the world economy, and that's where it stands today. It's interesting if you look at the rise of China's share of the world economy. It's come primarily at the expense of Japan and Europe, not the United States. So that means that if you're going to think about a provision of international order, the U.S. are still the largest country. And you get back to this question of free riding, which is if the largest participant doesn't take the lead, others are not going to. And then the question is whether in that chaotic situation, not only the world, whether it's better off, but is the largest participant better off? And I think it's better to produce that degree of order, even though sometimes it's self-serving and may have aspects of hypocrisy. The alternative of let's say chaotic order is, or it's almost an oxymoron there, but a chaotic situation is going to be worse for everyone.
As this interview does come to a close with about 5 minutes left, I want to maybe think about you and your specific role in American history. In the last few decades, you've been quite involved. And maybe you can speak from your own personal experience, but how hopeful are you for not only the future of America, but a future where countries can be more cooperative with each other? Because as it stands now, 2025, things don't look hopeful, at least in my eyes.
Well, I conclude my memoir with a phrase that I have a faint ray of guarded optimism. But there are many things that challenge that, which I discuss in the final chapter. So that's why I call it a faint ray. But I still think if you look at history, you'll see that we have come through worse periods. After all, in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt thought we might be at the death knell of democracy in America. And in the 1960s, you had, cities in flames and bombs going off. I had a bomb that went off in my building at Harvard. And we overcame that. I think the period we're going through right now is another trough, but I think that there's a resilience in the culture, which suggests that we'll get through it. But as I said, it's guarded optimism. It's not full optimism.
I feel like there is a feeling among many that a large part of this situation that we've ended up in is due to Western hypocrisy. And I don't know how much you'd agree, but even stretching back to Iraq, it is the saving of democracy is done through the killing of hundreds and thousands of people, right? The current war in Ukraine, many people would argue, is the cause of NATO expansionism, the exact sort of thing that NATO kind of accuses Russia of is expanding. So while these are not direct comparisons, I think a lot of people, especially now with the war in Gaza, feel that the West pushes certain ideas and ideals, but doesn't hold them themselves.
Well, I think there's always hypocrisy in international relations. Reconciling state interests with an ideal international order is bound to produce accusations of hypocrisy. But I think the argument that Putin's invasion of Ukraine was caused by NATO expansion is, I mean, it's a popular meme, but just simply not true. There was no prospect that NATO was going to expand to include Ukraine in 2016 or in 2022. And if you read what Putin wrote in 2021 about denying that Ukraine was a real nation and arguing that it was part of Russia, that tells you a lot more about why he invaded than the pretext that he used. On the Middle East, I think there is a lot of hypocrisy. I think that, what you have is a brutal assault by Hamas against Israel, where they killed a great many Israeli citizens. And then you have the Israelis responding in what might be a just war, but they don't observe the principles of just war, which is discrimination and minimizing the amount of civilian casualties. And in that sense, even though you can say that the cause of the Israeli response was just, responding to the Hamas attack, the methods which they used did not adhere to what we would call a just war principle. So there is hypocrisy there.
Thank you. I mean, as it stands, we don't have time to go into the wider historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which I suppose might beg many more questions about its beginnings. But we can leave it there. We can leave it up to the audience to kind of come to their own conclusions after this conversation. We'll leave the link to your latest book in the description, which I've been reading. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm thoroughly enjoying it. So congratulations on that front. I was wondering if you had any closing thoughts for our audience after this conversation.
Well, I must say that I was a student at Oxford reading PPE many years ago.
Right.
And one of the things I learned is that keeping a larger sense of historical perspective allows you to have a little bit of distance from when you're interpreting current events. So read your history.
Thank you, Joseph Nye. This has been the Critical Edge Podcast, signing off. Hi, guys. Thanks for watching this interview with Joseph Nye. As you may have realized, Ollie crashed out there due to some technical issues, but he was watching the whole time from the sidelines, giving his moral support. If you want to watch more content from us, you can click right here. And in the meantime, keep thinking.